This is Audible.
Market Forces by Richard K. Morgan. Narrated by Simon Vance. Copyright 2005 by Richard K. Morgan. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Ballantine Books, a division of Random House Incorporated, and was produced in the year 2005 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Market Forces is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are the products of the author's imagination, or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual events, locales, or persons living or dead is entirely coincidental. Prologue. Checkout. The shiny black plastic swipes through. Nothing. The machine fails in its habitual insectile chittering, and the screen blinks, as if outraged at what it has been fed. The checkout girl looks up at the woman who has handed her the card and smiles a little too widely. It's a smile that contains as much genuine emotion as there is fruit juice in a carton of Five Fruit Delish.
Are you sure you want to use this card?
Up to her arms in bagged groceries, the woman sets down the 2-year-old she has been propping against the checkout flange and looks back to where her husband is still unloading the last of the brightly colored cans and packages from the cart.
Martin?
Yeah, what?
Voice irritable with the household task they've just completed.
The card doesn't...
Doesn't what?
He meets her eyes and reads the distress there, then switches to the checkout girl. His voice comes out tight.
Run it again, please. Must have glitched.
The girl shrugs and swipes the card a second time. The screen flickers with the same disdain. Transaction denied. The girl takes the card and hands it back to the woman. A small pocket of quiet expands around the action, bubbling out past the conveyor belt to the boy at the next checkout unit, and to the 3 customers waiting behind Martin. In a few more seconds it will dissolve into the slither of whispering.
"Would you like to try another card?"
"This is ridiculous," snaps Martin. "That account had funds as of the 1st of the month. I've just been paid."
"I can run the card a 3rd time," the girl offers with studied indifference.
"No." The woman's knuckles have gone white around the small piece of black plastic.
"Martin, try the Intex."
"Helen, there's money in that
"Some problem?" asks the man behind him, tapping his own plastic significantly against the pile of groceries he has assembled so close to the next-customer divide that it's in danger of tumbling over into Martin's space.
Martin's mouth shuts like a trap.
"No problem."
He hands over the blue-flecked Intex card and watches at least as intently as the people behind him while the checkout girl swipes it. The machine chews it over for a couple of moments and spits it out. The girl hands it back and shakes her head. Her smooth, plastic politeness is beginning to degrade.
"Card's blocked," she says dismissively. "Terminal audit."
"What?"
"Terminal audit. I'm going to have to ask you to put those purchases back on the far side of the counter and leave the store."
"Run the card again."
The girl sighs.
"I don't have to run the card again, sir. I have all the information I need right here. Your rating is invalidated."
"Martin," Helen presses forward at his side,
"leave it. We'll come back when it's cleared up."
"No, God damn it!"
Martin shrugs her off and leans over the counter into the checkout girl's face.
"There is money in that account. Now swipe the card again."
"Better do as she says," says the pushy customer behind him.
Martin swings on him, tensed.
"This got something to do with you?"
"I am waiting."
"Well, wait some fucking more!"
He snaps his fingers in the man's face, dismissing him, and the pushy customer flinches back. Martin turns back to the checkout girl.
"Now, you—"
The prod hits him in the side like a rude elbow. A heartbeat later, the charge shocks him off the counter and into a seemingly immense clear space. He hits the floor, smelling burned fabric. He hears Helen shriek.
sees confusedly from floor level, boots in front of him and a voice that sounds like tearing cardboard at a great height.
"I think you'd better leave the store, sir."
The security guard hauls him to his feet and props him against the counter again. A big man, swelling at the waist, but watchful and hard around the eyes. He's been doing this for a long time. Probably cut his teeth on Corden's own clubs before he got this gig. He's shocked men before, and Martin is out of office clothes at 4:30 on a Wednesday afternoon, casual in faded jeans and a well-worn crew-necked pullover that doesn't show what it was once worth. The security guard thinks he has the measure of this one. He doesn't know. Can't know. Martin comes off the counter. The palm heel strike smashes the guard's nose flat. The knee goes in at groin level. As the guard falls, Martin drives into the base of his skull with one clenched fist. The guard hits the ground, a dead weight.
"Stand where you are."
Martin reels around and comes face to face with the guard's smaller female partner, just as she clears a pistol from her holster. Still scrambled from the cattle prod, he lurches the wrong way, toward her. And the guard blows his brains out all over his wife, and son, and the checkout girl, and all the shiny packaged items on the belt that they can no longer afford. File number 1. Initial Investment. Chapter 1. Awake. Jackknifed, there, in sweat. Fragments of the dream still pinning his breath in his throat, and his face into the pillow. Mind reeling in the darkened room. Reality settled over him like a fresh sheet. He was home. He heaved a shuddering sigh and groped for the glass of water beside the bed. In the dream, he'd been falling to and then through the tiles of the supermarket floor. On the other side of the bed, Carla stirred and laid a hand on him.
"Chris?"
"It's okay. Dream," he gulped from the glass. "Bad dream, Sol."
"Murchison again?"
He paused, peculiarly unwilling to correct her assumption. He didn't dream about Murchison's screaming death much any more. He shivered a little. Carla sighed and pulled herself closer to him. She took his hand and pressed it onto one full breast.
"My father would just love this. Deep stirrings of conscience. He's always said you haven't got one."
"Right." Chris lifted the alarm clock and focused on it. 3:20. Just perfect. He knew he wouldn't get back to sleep for a while. Just fucking perfect. He flopped back, immobile. "Your father has convenient amnesia when it comes to clearing the rent."
"Money talks. Why do you think I married you?"
He rolled his head and butted her gently on the nose. "Are you taking the piss out of me?" For answer, she reached down for his prick and rolled it through her fingers.
"No, I'm winding you up," she whispered.
As they drew together, he felt the hot gust of desire for her blowing out the dream, but he was slow to harden under her hand. It was only in the final throes of climax that he finally let go. Falling. It was raining when the alarm sounded. Soft hiss outside the open window like an untuned TV at very low volume. He snapped off the bleeper, lay listening to the rain for a few moments, and then slid out of the bed without waking Carla. In the kitchen he set up the coffee machine, ducked into the shower, and got out in time to steam milk for Carla's cappuccino. He delivered it to her bedside, kissed her awake, and pointed it out. She'd probably drift off to sleep again and drink it cold when she finally got up. He lifted clothes from the wardrobe, plain white shirt, one of the dark Italian suits, the Argentine leather shoes. He took them downstairs. Dressed but untied, he carried his own double espresso into the living room with a slice of toast to watch the 7 o'clock bulletins. There was, as usual, a lot of detailed foreign commentary, and it was time to go before the promotions and appointments spot rolled around. He shrugged, killed the TV, and only remembered to knot his tie when he caught himself in the hall mirror. Carla was just making awake noises as he slipped out of the front door and disabled the alarms on the Saab.
He stood in the light rain for a long moment, looking at the car. Soft beads of water glistening on the cold, grey metal. Finally, he grinned.
"Conflict investment. Here we come," he muttered, and got in.
He got the bulletins on the radio. They started promotions and appointments as he hit the Elsenham Junction ramp. Liz Linshaw's husky tones, just a touch of the cordon zones to roughen up the otherwise cultured voice. On TV, she dressed like a cross between a government arbitrator and a catered party exotic dancer. And in the last 2 years, she had graced the pages of every men's lifestyle magazine on the rack. The discerning exec's wet dream, and by popular acclaim, the AM ratings queen of the nation.
"Very few challenges on the roads this week," she told him huskily. "The Congo bid playoff we've all been waiting on is postponed till next week. You can blame the weather forecasts for that, though it looks from my window as if those guys have blown it again. There's less rain coming down than we had for Saunders Nakamura. Still nothing on the no-name orbital call-out for Mike Bryant at Shawn Associates. Don't know where you've got to, Mike, but if you can hear me, we're anxious to hear from you. And so, to new appointments this week. Jeremy Tealby makes partner at Collister McLean. I think we've all seen that coming for a long time now. And Carol Dexter upgrades to senior market overseer for Mariner Sketch following her spectacular performance last week against Roger Inglis. Now back to Shawn again, for word of a strong newcomer in the conflict investment division."
Chris's eyes flickered from the road to the radio. He touched up the volume a notch.
"Christopher Faulkner, headhunted from investment giants Hammett McCall, where he's already made a name for himself in emerging markets. Regular Prom and App followers may recall Chris's remarkable string of successes at Hammett McCall, commencing with the swift elimination of rival Edward Quain, an exec some 23 years his senior at the time. Vindication of the move came rapidly when..."
Excitement ran an abrupt slice into her voice.
"Oh, and this just in from our helicopter team. The no-name call-out on Mike Bryant has broken, with two of the challengers down past Junction 22 and the third signalling a withdrawal. Bryant's vehicle has apparently sustained minimal damage, and he's on his way now. We'll have in-depth coverage and an exclusive interview for the lunchtime edition. Looks like the start of a good week for Shawn Associates, then, and I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this morning. So back to the current affairs desk. Paul?"
"Thank you, Liz. First up, the falling rates of production in the manufacturing sector threaten a further 10,000 jobs across the NAFTA territories, according to an analysis by the Glasgow-based Independent News Group. A Trade and Finance Commission spokesman has called the report subversively negative. More on the..."
Chris tuned it out, vaguely annoyed that Bryant's no-name scuffle had knocked his name off Liz Linshaw's crimson lips. The rain had stopped, and his wipers were beginning to squeak. He switched them off and shot a glance at the dashboard clock. He was still running early. The proximity alarm chimed. He caught the accelerating shape in the otherwise deserted rear view and slewed reflexively right, into the next lane, brake back. As the other vehicle drew level, he relaxed. The car was battered and primer painted in mottled tan, custom-built like his own, but not by anyone who had any clue about road raging. Heavy steel barbs welded onto the front fenders, bulky external armouring folded around the front wheels and jutting back to the doors. The rear wheels were broad-tired to provide some manoeuvring stability, but it was still clear from the way the car moved that it was carrying far too much weight. No-namer. Like 15-year-old cordon zone thugs, they were often the most dangerous because they had the most to prove, the least to lose. The other driver was hidden behind a slat-protected side window, but Chris could see movement. He thought he made out the glimmer of a pale face. Along the car's flank flashed the driver number in luminous yellow paint. He sighed and reached for the comm set.
"Driver control," said an anonymous male voice. "This is Chris Faulkner of Shawn Associates, driver clearance 260B354R, inbound on M11 past Junction 10. I have a possible no-name challenger number X23657.
"Checking. A moment, please."
Chris began to build his speed. gradually so that the no-namer would soak up the acceleration without tripping into fight mode. By the time the controller came back on, they were pacing each other at about 140 kilometers an hour.
"That's confirmed, Faulkner. Your challenger is Simon Fletcher, freelance legal analyst."
Chris grunted. Unemployed lawyer.
"Challenge filed at 804. There's a bulk transporter in the slow lane passing junction 8, automated. Heavy load, otherwise no traffic. You are cleared to proceed."
Chris floored it. He made a full car length and slewed back in front of the other vehicle, forcing Fletcher to a split-second decision, ram or brake. The tan car dropped away, and Chris smiled a little. The brake reflex was instinctive. You had to have a whole different set of responses drilled into you before you could switch it off. After all, Fletcher should have wanted to ram him. It was a standard dual tactic. Instead, his instincts had gotten the better of him. This isn't going to last long. The lawyer accelerated again, closing. Chris let him get within about a meter of his rear fender, then hauled out and braked. The other car shot ahead and Chris tucked in behind. Junction 8 flashed past. Inside the London orbital now, almost into the zones. Chris calculated the distance to the underpass, nudged forward and tapped at Fletcher's rear. The lawyer shot away from the contact. Chris checked his speed display and upped it. Another tap. Another forward flinch. The automated haulage transport appeared like a monstrous metal caterpillar, ballooned in the slow lane and then dropped behind just as rapidly. The underpass came into sight. Concrete yellowed with age, stained with faded graffiti that predated the 5-meter exclusion fencing. The fence stuck up over the parapet, topped with springy rolls of razor wire. Chris had heard it carried killing voltage. He gave Fletcher another shove and then slowed to let him dive into the tunnel like a spooked rabbit. A couple of seconds of gentle braking, then accelerate again and in after him. Shutdown time. Beneath the weight of the tunnel's roof, things were different. Yellow lights above, 2 tip-to-tail rows of them, like tracer fire along the ceiling. Ghostly white emergency exit signs at intervals along the walls. No breakdown lane, just a scuffed and broken line to mark the edge of the metalled road and a thin concrete path for maintenance workers. A sudden first-person viewpoint arcade game. Enhanced sense of speed, fear of wall impact, and dark. Chris found Fletcher and closed. The lawyer was rattled, telegraphed clearly in the jerky way the car was handling. Chris took a wide swing out into the other lanes so that he'd disappear from Fletcher's rear-view mirror and matched velocity's dead level. 140 on the speedo again. Both cars were running dead level, and the underpass was only 8 kilometers long. Make it quick. Chris closed the gap between the two cars by a meter, flicked on his interior light, and leaning across to the passenger side window, raised one hand in stiff farewell. With the light on, Fletcher couldn't fail to see it. He held the pose for a long moment, then snapped the hand into a closed fist, with the thumb pointing down. At the same time, he slewed the car one-handed across the intervening lane. The results were gratifying. Fletcher must have been watching the farewell gesture, not the road ahead, and he forgot where he was. He jerked his car aside, pulled too far, and broadsided the wall in a shower of sparks. The primer-painted car staggered drunkenly, raked fire off the concrete once more, and bounced away in Chris's wake, tires shrieking. Chris watched in the mirror as the lawyer braked his vehicle to a sprawling halt sideways across 2 lanes. He grinned and slowed to about 50, waiting to see if Fletcher would pick up the challenge again. The other car showed no sign of restarting. It was still stationary when he hit the upward incline at the far end of the underpass and lost sight of it. "Wise man," he murmured to himself. He emerged from the tunnel into an unexpected patch of sunlight. The road vaulted, climbing onto a long raised curve that swept in over the expanses of zone land and angled toward the cluster of towers at the heart of the city. Sunlight struck down in selective rays. The towers gleamed. He accelerated into the curve. Chapter 2. The light in the washroom was subdued, filtering down from high windows set in the sloping roof. Chris rinsed his hands in the onyx basin and stared at himself in the big circular mirror. The Saab grey eyes that looked back at him were clear and steady. The barcode tattoos over his cheekbones picked up the colour and mixed it with threads of lighter blue. Lower still, the blue repeated in the weave of his suit and on one of the twisted lines in his Susanna Ingram tie. The shirt shone white against his tan, and when he grinned, the silver tooth caught the light in the room like an audible chime. Good enough. The sound of splashing water ran on after he killed the tap. He glanced sideways to see another man washing his hands two basins down. The new arrival was big, the length of limb and bulk of trunk habitually used to model suits, and long fair hair tied back in a ponytail. An Armani-suited Viking. Chris almost looked for a double-bladed battle-axe resting against the basin at the man's side. Instead, one of the hands emerged from the basin, and he saw, with a sudden, visceral shock, that it was liberally stained with blood. The other man looked up and met his gaze.
"Something I can help you with?"
Chris shook his head and turned to the hand dryer on the wall. Behind him he heard the water stop in the basin, and the other man joined him at the dryer. Chris acknowledged the arrival and gave a little space, rubbing away the last traces of moisture on his hands. The dryer ran on. The other man was looking at him closely.
"Hey, you must be the new guy."
He snapped his fingers wetly. There was still some blood on them. Chris saw tiny flecks and some in the lines of his palm.
"Chris something, right?"
"Faulkner."
"Yeah, Faulkner, that's it."
He put his hands under the flow of air.
"Just come in from Hammett McColl."
"Right."
"I'm Mike Bryant."
A hand offered sideways. Chris hesitated briefly, eyeing the blood. Bryant picked up on it.
"Oh, yeah, sorry. I was just in a no-namer. And Sean policy is you've got to recover their plastic as proof of the kill. It can get messy."
"Had a no-namer myself this morning," Chris said reflexively.
"Yeah? Where was that?"
M-11. Around Junction 8.
"The underpass. You take him down in there?"
Chris nodded, deciding on the spur of the moment not to mention the inconclusive nature of the engagement.
"Nice. I mean, no-namers don't get you anywhere much, but it's all rep, I guess."
"I guess."
"You're up for conflict investment, aren't you? Louise Hewitt's section. I'm up there on the 53rd myself. She was batting your resume about a few weeks back. That stuff you did at Hammett McColl way back was some serious shit. Welcome aboard."
"Thanks."
"I'll walk you up there if you like. Going that way myself."
"Great." They stepped out into the broad curve of the corridor and a glass wall view of the financial district from 20 floors up. Bryant seemed to drink it in for a moment before he turned up the corridor, still scratching at a persistent speck of blood on his hand.
"Did I give you a car yet?"
"Got my own, customized. My wife's a mechanic." Bryant stopped and looked at him.
"No shit?"
"No shit." Chris held up his left hand, the dull metal band on the ring finger. Bryant examined it with interest.
"What's that? Steel?"
He caught on and grinned suddenly.
"Out of an engine, right? I've read about this stuff."
"Titanium. Got it off an old Saab venting chamber. Had to resize it, but apart from that..."
"Yeah, that's right."
The other man's enthusiasm was almost childlike.
"Did you do it over an engine block? Like that guy in Milan last year?"
The finger snap again.
"What was his name? Bonacello or something?"
"Bonacelli. Yeah, like that. Pretty much." Chris tried to keep the annoyance out of his voice. His engine-block-alter marriage predated the Italian drivers by some 5 years, but went almost unnoticed in the driving press. Bonacelli's ran for weeks, in full colour. Maybe something to do with the fact that Silvio Bonacelli was the hell-raising younger son of a big Florentine driving family. Maybe just that he had married not a mechanic, but a former porn star and blossoming manufactured pop singer. Maybe also the fact that Chris and Carla had done it with a minimum of fuss in the backyard of Mel's auto fix, and Silvia Bonacelli had invited the crowned heads of corporate Europe to a ceremony on a cleared shop floor at the new Lancia works in Milan. That was the trick with the 21st century's corporate nobility. Family contacts.
Marry your mechanic.
Bryant was grinning again.
Man, I can see where that would be useful. But I've got to tell you, I admire your courage.
It wasn't really a courage thing, Chris said mildly. I was in love. You married?
Yeah,
he saw Chris looking at his ring.
Oh, platinum. Suki's a bond trader for Costermans. Mostly works from home these days, and she's probably going to quit if we have another kid.
You got kids?
Yeah, just the one. Ariana.
They reached the end of the corridor and a battery of elevators. Bryant dug in his jacket pocket while they waited and produced a wallet. He flipped it open to reveal an impressive rack of credit cards and a photo of an attractive, auburn-haired woman holding a pixie-faced child.
Look, we took that on her birthday. She was one, nearly a year ago. They grow up fast. You got kids?
No, not yet.
Well, all I can tell you is don't wait too long.
Bryant flipped the wallet closed as the elevator arrived, and they rode up in companionable silence. The lift announced each floor in a chatty tone and gave them brief outlines of current Shawn development projects. After a while, Chris spoke, more to drown out the earnest, synthetic voice than anything else. This place have its own combat classes.
What, hand to hand? Bryant grinned. Look at that number, Chris. 41. Up here you don't go hand to hand for promotion. Louise Hewitt would consider that the height of bad taste.
Chris shrugged. Yeah, but you never know. Saved my life once.
Hey, I'm kidding.
Bryant patted him on the arm.
They've got a couple of corporate instructors down in the gym, sure. Shotokan and Taekwondo, I think. I do some Shotokan myself sometimes, just to stay in shape. Plus you never know when you might wind up in the cordon zones.
He winked.
Know what I mean? But anyway, like one of my instructors says, learning a martial art won't teach you to fight. You want to learn that shit, go to the street and get in some fights. That's how you really learn.
A grin.
At least, that's what they tell me.
The elevator bounced to a halt. 53rd floor, it said brightly. Conflict Investment Division. Please ensure you have a code 7 clearance for this level. Have a nice day. They stepped out into a small antechamber where a well-groomed security officer nodded to Bryant and asked Chris for ID. Chris found the barcoded strip they'd given him at ground floor reception and waited while it was scanned.
Look, Chris, I've got to run.
Bryant nodded at the right-hand corridor.
Some greasy little dictator's uplinking in for a budget review at 10, and I'm still trying to remember the name of his defense minister. You know how it is. I'll catch you at the quarterly review on Friday. We usually go out after.
Sure. See you later. Chris watched him out of sight with apparent casualness. Beneath was the same caution he'd applied to the no-name challenger that morning. Bryant seemed friendly enough, but almost everyone did, under the right circumstances. Even Carla's father could seem like a reasonable man in the right conversational light. And anyone who washed blood off his hands the way Mike Bryant did was not someone Chris wanted at his back. The security guard handed back his pass and pointed to the twin doors straight ahead. "Conference room," she said. "They're waiting for you." The last time Chris had been face to face with a senior partner was to hand in his resignation at Hammett McCall. Vincent McCall had a high-windowed room, panelled in dark wood and lined along one wall with books that looked 100 years old. There were portraits of illustrious partners from the firm's 80-year history on the other walls, and a framed photo of his father shaking hands with Margaret Thatcher on the desk. The floor was waxed wood, overlaid with a 200-year-old Turkish carpet. McCall himself had silvery hair, buttoned his slim frame into suits a generation out of date, and refused to have a video phone in his office. The whole place was a shrine to hallowed tradition, an odd thing in itself for a man whose primary responsibility was a division called Emerging Markets. Jack Notley, Shawn Associates' ranking senior in conflict investment, could not have been less like McCall if he'd been on temporary reassignment from an inverted parallel universe. He was a stocky, powerful-looking man with close and not especially well-cropped black hair that was just beginning to show a seasoning of grey. His hands were ruddy and blunt-fingered. His suit was a Susanna Ingram original that had probably cost as much as the Saab's whole original chassis, and the body it clothed looked fit for a boxing ring. His features were rough-hewn, and there was a long, jagged scar under his right eye. The eyes were keen and bright. Only the fine web of lines around them gave any indication of Notley's 47 years. Chris thought he looked like a troll on vacation in Elfland as he moved across the light-filled, pastel-shaded reception area. His handshake, predictably, was a bone-crusher.
"Chris! Great to have you aboard at last. Come on in. I'd like you to meet some people."
Chris disentangled his fingers and followed the troll's broad back across the room to where a lower central level housed a wide coffee table, a pair of right-angled sofas, and a conspicuously unique meeting leader's armchair. Seated at either end of one sofa were a man and a woman, both younger than Notley. Chris's eyes focused automatically on the woman, a second before Notley spoke and gestured at her.
"This is Louise Hewitt, divisional manager and executive partner. She's the real brains behind what we're doing here."
Hewitt unfolded herself from the sofa and leaned across to take his hand. She was a good-looking, voluptuous woman in her late 30s, working hard at not showing it. Her suit looked Daisuke Todoroki, severe black, vented driver's skirt to the knees and square-cut jacket. Her shoes had no appreciable heel. She wore long, dark hair gathered back from pale features in a knot and minimal makeup. Her handshake wasn't trying to prove anything.
"And this is Philip Hamilton, junior partner for the division."
Chris turned to face the deceptively soft-looking man at the other end of the sofa. Hamilton had a weak chin and a fat bulk that made him untidy, even in his own charcoal Ingram, but his pale blue eyes missed absolutely nothing. He stayed seated, but offered up a damp hand and a murmured greeting. There was, Chris thought, a guarded dislike in his voice.
"Well now," said Notley in jovial tones, "I'm not really much more than a figurehead around here, so I'll hand over to Louise for the moment. Let's all take a seat, and would you like a drink?"
"Green tea, if you've got it."
"Certainly. I think a pot would be in order. Jiang Estate okay?"
Chris nodded, impressed. Notley walked up to the large desk near one of the windows and prodded a phone. Louise Hewitt seated herself with immaculate poise and looked across at Chris.
"I've heard a lot about you, Faulkner," she said neutrally.
"Great."
Still neutral. "Not entirely, as it happens. There are one or two items I'd like to clear up, if you don't mind."
Chris spread his hands. "Go ahead. I work here now."
"Yes."
The thin smile told him she hadn't missed the counter-blow.
"Well, perhaps we could start with your vehicle. I understand you've turned down the company car. Do you have something against the House of BMW?"
"Well, I think they have a tendency to over-armour. Apart from that, no. It was a very generous offer. But I have my own vehicle, and I'd rather stick with what I know, if it's all the same to you. I'll feel more comfortable."
"Customized," said Hamilton,
as if naming a psychological dysfunction.
"What's that?"
Notley was back, settling predictably into the armchair.
"Ah, your wheels, Chris. Yes, I heard you're married to the woman who put it together. That is right, isn't it?"
"That's right." Chris took a flickered inventory of the expressions around him. In Notley he seemed to read an avuncular tolerance, in Hamilton distaste, and in Louise Hewitt nothing at all.
"That must give you quite a bond,"
Notley amused, almost to himself. Yes. Yes, it does."
"I'd like to talk about the Bennett incident," Louise Hewitt said loudly.
Chris locked gazes with her for a beat, then sighed. "The details are pretty much as I filed them. You must have read about it at the time. Bennett was up for the same analyst's post as me. Fight lasted to that raised section on the M40 inflow. I swiped her off the road on a bend, and she stuck on the edge. Weight of the car would have pulled her over sooner or later. She was running a reconditioned Jag Mentor." Notley grunted. A used-to-run-one-myself sort of noise. "Anyway, I stopped and managed to pull her out. The car went over a couple of minutes later. She was semi-conscious when I got her to the hospital. I think she hit her head on the steering wheel."
The hospital?
Hamilton's voice was politely disbelieving.
Excuse me? You took her to the hospital?
Chris stared at him. Yeah, I took her to the hospital. Is there a problem with that?
Well,
Hamilton laughed.
Let's just say people around here might have seen it that way.
What if Bennett had decided to have another crack at the post?
Hewitt asked gravely, detached counterpoint to her junior partner's hilarity. Chris thought it rang rehearsed. He shrugged.
What, with cracked ribs, a broken right arm, and head injuries? The way I remember it, she was in no condition to do anything but some heavy breathing.
But she did recover, right?
Hamilton asked slyly.
She's still working. Still in London.
Back at Hammett McColl,
Hewitt confirmed, still detached. The jab, Chris knew, was going to come from Hamilton's corner.
That way you left, Chris?
The junior partner was right on cue, voice still tinged lightly with derision.
No stomach to finish the job?
What I think Louise and Philip are trying to say,
Notley interposed, the kindly uncle at a birthday party dispute, is that you didn't resolve matters. Would that be a fair summary, Louise?
Hewitt nodded curtly. It would.
I stayed at HM 2 years after Bennett, said Chris, keeping his temper. He hadn't expected this so early. She honored her defeat as expected. The matter was resolved to my satisfaction and to the firm's. Notley made soothing gestures.
Yes, yes, perhaps then this is more a question of corporate culture than blame. What we value here at Shawn is, how shall I put it, well, yes, resolution, I suppose. We don't like loose ends. They can trip you and us up at a later date. As you see with the embarrassment the Bennett incident is causing us all here and now, we are left in a, shall we say, an ambiguous situation. Now, that couldn't have happened had you resolved the matter in a terminal fashion. It's the kind of ambiguity we like to avoid at Shawn Associates. It doesn't fit our image, especially in a field as competitive as conflict investment. I'm sure you understand.
Chris looked around at the three faces, counting the friends and enemies he appeared to have already made. He manufactured a smile. Of course, he said. Nobody likes ambiguity. Chapter 3. The gun sat, unambiguously, in the middle of the desk, begging to be picked up. Chris put his hands in his pockets and looked at it with wary dislike.
This mine?
Heckler & Koch, Nemesis 10.
Hewitt strode past him and filled her hand with a black rubber butt.
The Nemex. Semi-automatic, double-action, hesitation lock, no safety necessary.
Just pull it out and start shooting. Standard Shawn issue. Comes with a shoulder holster so you can wear it under a suit. You never know when you'll have to give a coup de grace.
He fought down a smirk. Maybe she saw it.
We've got ways of doing things here, Faulkner. If you call someone out, you don't take them to the hospital afterward. You go in and you finish the job, with this, if necessary.
She pointed the pistol one-handed at the data-down unit built into the desk. There was a dry click as she pulled the trigger.
If you can, you bring back their plastic.
Speaking of which,
she reached inside her jacket pocket with her free hand and produced a small grey rectangle. Light flashed on the entwined red S and A of a Shawn Associates holologo. She tossed the card onto the table and laid the gun down beside it.
There you are. Don't get separated from either. You never know when you'll need firepower.
Chris picked up the card and tapped it thoughtfully on the desktop. He left the gun where it was.
Clips are in the top drawer of your desk. It's a jacketed load. Should go through the engine block of a bulk transporter. You actually used to drive one of those things, didn't you? Mobile arbitrage or something?
Yeah. Chris pulled out his wallet and racked the card. He looked back up at Hewitt expectantly. So?
No, nothing.
Hewitt walked past him to the window and looked out at the world below.
I think it was an inspired idea, selling commodities from a haulage base. But it's not quite the same thing as driving for an investment bank, is it?
Chris smiled a little and seated himself on the corner of the desk, back to the window and his new boss.
You don't like me very much, do you, Hewitt?
This isn't about like, Faulkner. I don't think you belong here,
Well, someone evidently does.
He heard her coming back to the desk and turned his head casually toward her as she arrived. Behind her, he suddenly noticed how bleak the undecorated office was.
Well, look at that, she said softly. Got me back here, didn't you? Is that the kind of power play you're used to? You won't cut it here, Faulkner. I've seen your resume. Big kill 8 years back with Quayne, nothing much since. You got lucky, that's all.
Chris kept his voice mild. So did Hammett McCall. They saved about 15 mil in bonus payments when Quayne went down, and I haven't needed to do much killing since. Sometimes it's just enough to do the work. You don't have to be proving yourself all the time.
Here you do. You'll find that out.
Really? Chris pulled out the top drawer and looked in at the contents, as if they interested him marginally more than the woman in front of him. You got some toy boy lined up to call me out for this office?
For just a moment, he had her.
He caught it in the way her frame stiffened at the upper edges of his peripheral vision. Then she drew a long breath, as if Chris were a new flower she liked the scent of. As he looked up, she smiled.
Cute, she said. Ooh, you're cute. Notley likes you, you know that? That's why you're here. You remind him of him, back when he was young. He came out of nowhere just like you, riding one big kill. He had a tattoo just like you. Stream of currency signs, like tears down from one eye. Very classy.
Her lip curled.
He even dated his mechanic for about 5 years. Little zone girl with a smudge of grease across her nose. They say she even turned up at a quarterly dinner once with that smudge. Yeah, Notley likes you. But you notice something about that tattoo? It's gone now. Just like that little zone girl. See, Notley gets sentiment attacks sometimes, but he's a professional and he won't let it get in the way. Hold that thought, because you're going to disappoint him, Faulkner. You don't have the grit. Welcome aboard.
Hewitt looked at him blankly. Chris gestured with one open hand. I thought one of us should say it.
Hey. She shrugged and turned to leave. Prove me wrong.
Chris watched her go, face unreadable. As the door closed, his eyes fell on the matte black Nemex pistol on the desk, and his own lip twisted derisively.
Fucking cowboys.
He swept the gun ceremonially away with the clips and slammed the drawer closed. There was a list of induction suggestions on the data down, people to call, when to call them, and where they could be found. Procedures to implement, the best time to access the areas of the Shawn data stack necessary for each procedure. A selected overview of his caseload for the next 2 months, flags to indicate which needed attention first. The PA package had phased everything into a suggested convenience sequence that got the work done as efficiently as possible, and told him he would find it most convenient to go home at about 8:30 that evening. He toyed briefly with the idea of loading up the Nemex with its jacketed ammunition and repeating Hewitt's target practice on the data down. Instead, he punched the phone.
Carla, this is Chris. I'm going to be late tonight, so don't wait up. There's still some chili in the fridge. Try not to eat it all. It'll give you the shits. And I'd like some myself when I get in. Oh, by the way, I'm in love.
He put down the receiver and looked at the data down screen. After a long pause, he prodded the bright orange triangle marked Conflict Investment, and watched as it maximized like an opening flower. The back glow lit his face. It was past 11 by the time he got home. He killed his lights at the first bend in the drive, though he knew that the crunch of his wheels on the gravel would wake Carla as surely as the play of high beams across the front of the house. Sometimes, she seemed to know he was home more by intuition than anything else. He parked beside the battered and patched Land Rover she ran, turned off his engine, and yawned. For a moment he sat in the still and the darkness, listening to the cooling tick of the engine. Home for 6 hours' sleep. Why the fuck did we move this far out? But he knew the answer to that.
This place is no different from HM. Live at work, sleep at home. Forget you ever had a relationship. Same shit, different logo. Well, that's where all the money comes from. He let himself into the house as quietly as he could and found Carla in the living room watching a TV screen tuned to the soft blue light of an empty channel. Ice clicked in her glass as she lifted it to her lips. "You're awake," he said, and then saw how far down the bottle she was. "You're drunk."
"Isn't that meant to be my line?"
"Not tonight, it isn't. I was wired to the fucking data down until 9:45. He bent to kiss her. "Rough day?"
"Not really. Same old shit."
"Yeah, done some of that myself." He sank into the chair beside her. She handed him the whiskey glass just a fraction of a second before he reached out for it. "What you watching?"
"Dex and Seth. Till the jamming got it."
He grinned.
"You're going to get us arrested."
"Not in this postcode."
"Oh, yeah." He glanced across at the phone deck. "Do we get any this morning?"
"Any what?"
"Any mail."
"Bills. Mortgage repayment went through."
"Already? They just took it."
"No, that was last month. We're over the line on a couple of cards as well."
Chris drank some of the peat-flavored Isla whiskey, tutting learnedly over the sacrilege of ice in a glass of single malt. Carla gave him a murderous look. He handed her back the glass and frowned at the TV screen.
"How do we manage that?"
"We spent the money, Chris."
"Well."
He stretched his suited legs out in front of him and yawned again.
"That's what we earn it for, I guess.
So what same old shit did you do today?"
"Salvage. Some arms supply company just moved into premises out on the northern verge, lost a dozen of their brand new Mercedes ramjets to vandals. Whole lot written off."
Chris sat up.
"A dozen? What did they do? Park them in the open?"
"No. Someone dropped a couple of homemade shrapnel bombs through a vent into their executive garages. Boom! Corrosives and fast-moving metal in all directions. Mel got a contract to assess the damage and haul every write-off away gratis. Paid to clear it, and he gets to keep whatever salvage we can strip out of the wrecks. And here's the good bit. Some of these mercs are barely scratched. Mel's still out celebrating. Says if the corporates are going to insist on this urban regeneration shit, we could have a lot more work like that. He must have put a good meter of name powder up his nose today."
"Shrapnel bombs, huh?"
"Yeah. Ingenious what kids can wire together out of scrap these days. I don't know. Maybe Mel even set them up to do it. Connections he's got in the zones. Jackers, drugs, gangwit stuff."
"Fuckers," Chris said vaguely.
"Yeah. Well,"
an edge crept into Carla's voice,
"amazing what you'll get up to when you've got nothing to lose. Nothing to do but stand at the razor wire and watch the wealth roll by."
Chris sighed.
"Carla, could we have this argument some other time, please? Because I haven't rehearsed in a while."
"You got something else you want to do?"
"Well, we could fuck by the light of the TV screen."
"We could," she agreed seriously, "except that I always end up on top, and I've still got carpet burns on my knees from the last time you had that bright idea. You want to fuck, you take me to bed."
"Deal."
After, as they lay like spoons in the disordered bed, Carla curled around his back and murmured into his ear,
"By the way, I'm in love."
"Me too."
He leaned back and rubbed the back of his head against her breasts. She shuddered at the touch of the close-cropped hair and reached instinctively for his shrunken prick. He grinned and slapped her hand away.
"Oi, that's your lot. Go to sleep, nympho."
"So, you just want to fuck me and leave me, is that it?"
"I'm," said Chris, already sliding headlong into sleep, "not going anywhere."
"Just use me, and then when you've used me, you go to sleep. Talk to me, you bastard."
A grunt.
"You haven't even told me how it went today."
Breathing. Carla propped herself up on one arm and prodded at the springy muscle in Chris's stomach.
"I'm serious.
What's conflict investment like?
Chris took her arm, folded the offending finger around his own, and tugged Carla back into the spoon configuration. Conflict investment is the way forward at a global level, he said.
Is that right?
It's what the Sean Datadown says.
Oh, it must be true, then.
He smiled reflexively at the scorn in her voice and began to drift away again. Just before he slept, Carla thought she heard him speak again. She lifted her head.
What?
He didn't respond, and she realized he was muttering in his dreams. Carla leaned over him, straining to catch something. She gave up after a couple of minutes. The only sense she succeeded in straining out of the soup of mumbling was a single, repeated word. Checkout. It took a long time to find sleep for herself. Chapter 4
Conflict investment is the way forward.
Applause rose and clattered at the glass roofing like the wings of pigeons startled into flight. Around the auditorium, men and women came to their feet, hands pumping together. The entire CI contingent of Sean Associates were gathered in the room. The youngest, Chris noticed, were the most fervent. Faces gashed open with enthusiasm, teeth and eyes gleaming in the late afternoon sun from roof and picture window. They looked ready to go on applauding till their hands bled. Sewn in among this crop of pure conviction, older colleagues clapped to a slower, more measured rhythm and nodded approval, leaning their heads together to make comments under the din of the applause. Louise Hewitt paused and leaned on the lectern, waiting for the noise to ebb. Behind his hand, Chris yawned cavernously.
"Yes, yes,"
Hewitt made damping motions. The room settled.
"We've heard it called risky, we've heard it called impractical, and we've heard it called immoral. In short, we've heard the same carping voices that free market economics has had to drag with it like a ball and chain from its very inception. But we have learned to ignore those voices. We have learned, and we have gone on learning, piling lesson upon lesson, vision upon vision, success upon success. And what every success has taught us, and continues to teach us again and again, is a very simple truth. Who has the finance?"
A dramatic pause. One slim, black-clad arm holding a clenched fist aloft.
"Has the power?"
Chris stifled another yawn.
"Human beings have been fighting wars as long as history recalls. It is in our nature, it is in our genes. In the last half of the last century, the peacemakers, the governments of this world, did not end war. They simply managed it, and they managed it badly. They poured money without thought of return into conflicts and guerrilla armies abroad, and then into tortuous peace processes that more often than not left the situation no better. They were partisan, dogmatic, and inefficient. Billions wasted in poorly assessed wars that no sane investor would have looked at twice. Huge, unwieldy national armies and clumsy international alliances. In short, a huge public sector drain on our economic systems. Hundreds of thousands of young people killed in parts of the world they could not even pronounce properly. Decisions based on political dogma and doctrine alone. Well, this model is no more."
Hewitt paused again. This time there was a charged quiet that carried with it the foretaste of applause the same way a thick heat carries with it the knowledge of the storm to come. In the closing moments of the address, Hewitt's voice had sunk close to normal conversational tones. Her delivery slowed and grew almost musing.
"All over the world, men and women still find causes worth killing and dying for. And who are we to argue with them? Have we lived in their circumstances? Have we felt what they feel? No. It is not our place to say if they are right or wrong. It is not for us to pass judgment or to interfere. At Sean Conflict Investment, we are concerned with only two things. Will they win? And will it pay? As in all other spheres, Sean will invest the capital it is entrusted with only where we are sure of a good return. We do not judge. We do not moralize. We do not waste. Instead, we assess, we invest, and we prosper. That is what it means to be a part of Sean Conflict Investment. The auditorium erupted once more.
Nice speech, said Notley, pouring champagne into the ring of glasses with an adept arm. And press coverage, too, thanks to Philip here. Should profile us nicely for license review on the 18th.
Glad you liked it. Hewitt lifted her filled glass away from the ring and looked around at the gathered partners. Excluding Philip Hamilton at her side, the five men and three women watching her accounted for 57% of Sean Associates' capital wealth. Each one of them could afford to acquire a private jet with less thought than she gave to shopping for shoes. Among the eight of them, there was no manufactured object on the planet that they could not own. It was wealth she could taste, just out of reach, like bacon frying in someone else's kitchen. Wealth she wanted like sex, wanted with a desire that ached in her gums and the pit of her stomach. Notley finished pouring and raised his own glass.
Well, here's to small wars everywhere. Long may they smoulder. And congratulations on a great quarterly result, Louise. Small wars. Small wars.
Small wars. Hewitt echoed the toast and sipped at her drink. She surfed the polite conversation on autopilot, and gradually the other partners began to drift back to the main body of the hotel bar, seeking out their own divisional acolytes. Hamilton caught her eye, and she nodded almost imperceptibly. He slipped away with a murmured excuse, leaving her with Notley. "You know," she said quietly, "I could have done without Faulkner falling asleep in the front row. He's too impressed with himself, Jack."
"Of course, you never were at his age."
"He's only 5 years younger than me. And anyway, I've always had these." Hewitt set her glass aside on the mantelpiece and cupped her breasts, as if offering them. "Nothing like a cleavage for reducing professional respect." Notley looked embarrassed, and then away.
"Oh, come on, Louise. Don't give me that tired old feminist rap again."
"Being a woman around here makes you tough, Jack." Hewitt let her hands fall again. "You know that's true. I had to claw my way up every centimetre of the way to partnership. Compared to that, Faulkner had it handed to him on a plate. One big kill, catch the imagination of App and Prom, and he's made. Just look at him. He didn't even shave this morning."
She gestured across the bar to where Chris appeared to be deep in conversation with a group of men and women his own age. Even at this distance, the dusting of stubble on his face was visible. As they watched, he masked another yawn with his glass.
"Give him a break, Louise."
Notley took her shoulder and turned her away again.
"If he can do for us what he did for Hammett McCall, I'll forgive him not shaving occasionally."
"And if he can't?"
Notley shrugged and tipped back his champagne.
"Then he won't last long, will he?"
He put down the glass, patted her on the shoulder again, and walked off into the press of suited bodies. Hewitt stayed where she was until Hamilton appeared noiselessly at her side.
"Well?"
he asked.
"Don't ask."
On the other side of the room, Chris was in fact deep in nothing other than the classic party nightmare. He was becalmed at the edges of a group he had only passing acquaintance with, listening politely to conversations he had no interest in about people and places he did not know. His jaws ached from trying not to yawn. He wanted nothing more than to bow out quietly and go home. 5 days into the new job? I don't think so, pal. Out of boredom, he went to the bar for a refill he didn't want. As he was waiting, someone nudged him. He glanced around. Mike Bryant, grin on full beam, with a Liz Linshaw clone in tow and a tray full of drinks in his hands.
"Hey, Chris!"
Bryant had to raise his voice above the crowd.
"How did you like Hewitt? Talks up a storm, doesn't she?"
Chris nodded noncommittally. Yeah, very inspiring.
You're not kidding. Really gets you in the guts. First time I heard her speak, I thought I'd been personally selected to lead a holy fucking crusade for global investment. Simeon Sands for the finance sector.
Mike did a passable burlesque of the satellite syndicated demagogue.
Hallelujah! I believe I have faith! Seriously, you look at the productivity graphs following each quarterly address she gives. Spikes through the roof, man.
Right.
Hey, you want to join us? We're sitting back on the windowsill there, see? Got some of the meanest analysts in creation gathered around those tables. Isn't that right, Liz?
The woman at Bryant's side chuckled. Shooting a glance at her, Chris suddenly realized this was no clone.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Liz Linshaw, Chris Faulkner. Chris, you know Liz, I guess. Either that or you don't have a TV.
Miss Linshaw. Chris stuck out his hand. Liz Linshaw laughed and leaned forward to kiss him on both cheeks.
Call me Liz, she said. I recognize you now, from the app and prom sheets this week. You're the one who took down Edward Quayne in 41, aren't you?
Yeah.
Before my time, I was just a stringer on a pirate satellite cast in those days. Quite a kill. I don't think there's been one like it in the last 8 years.
Stop it. You're making me feel old. Will you two stop flirting and grab some of these drinks? Demanded Bryant. I've got a dozen thirsty animals back there to water. What do you want in that, Chris?
Lefrague. No ice.
Yuck!
Among the three of them, they carried the glasses over to the tables and unloaded. Bryant pushed and shoved at people, joking and cajoling and bullying until he had space for Chris and Liz to sit at his table. He raised his glass.
Small wars, he said. Long may they smoulder.
Approval. Choral in volume. Chris found himself squeezed in next to a tall, slim executive with steel-rimmed glasses and the air of a scientist peering down a microscope lens at everything. Chris felt a ripple of irritation. Affected eyewear had always been one of Carla's pet hates. Fucking poverty chic, she invariably snarled when she saw the ads. Fake fucking human imperfection. It'll be cool to ride around in a fucking wheelchair next. It's fucking offensive. Chris tended to agree. Sure, you could run a data-down uplink projected onto the inside of the lenses, but that wasn't it. Carla was right. It was zone chic. And why the fuck pretend you couldn't afford corrective surgery when everything else you were wearing screamed the opposite?
Nick Makin, said the narrow face behind the lenses, extending a long arm sideways across his body. The grip belied his slender frame. You are Faulkner, aren't you?
That's right. Mike Bryant leaned across the table toward them.
Nick was our top commission analyst last year. Predicted that turnaround in Guatemala over the summer. Went against all the models for guerrilla conflict that we had. It was a real coup for Sean.
Congratulations, said Chris.
Ah, Makin waved it off. That was last season. Can't live off things like that indefinitely. It's a whole new quarter. Time for fresh meat. Another new approach. Speaking of which, Chris, aren't you the guy who let a promotion challenger off the hook at Hammett McColl last year?
Probably imagination, the way the whole table was suddenly listening to this sharkish young man with a carefully masked speech impediment. Probably. Chris's eyes flickered to Bryant. The big blonde was watching.
You heard about that, huh?
Yeah, Makin smiled. It seemed kind of odd, you know?
Well, Chris offered, making a stiff smile of his own. You weren't there.
No. Lucky for Alicia Bennett that I wasn't, I'd say. Isn't she still around somewhere?
I assume so. You know, Nick, I tend not to worry too much about the past. Like you said, it's a whole new quarter. Bennett was 2 years ago.
Still?
Makin looked around the table, apparently to enlist some support.
An attitude like that must make for a lot of challengers. Shit, I'd dive against you myself just for the experience, if I thought you'd have a sentiment attack like that after the event. If I lost, that is.
Chris realized abruptly that Makin was drunk alcohol-fueled aggressive and waiting. He looked at his glass on the table. "You would lose," he said quietly. By now it wasn't his imagination. The buzz of conversation was definitely weakening as the executives lost interest in what they were discussing and became spectators.
"Big words," Machen had lost his smile, "from a man who hasn't made a kill in nearly 4 years."
Chris shrugged, one eye on Machen's left hand where it rested on the tabletop. He mapped options. Reach down and pinion the arm. Snap the little finger of that hand. Take it from there.
"Actually," said a husky voice, "I think they're quite small words from the man who took down Edward Quain."
The focus of attention leapt away across the table. Liz Linshaw sat with one long-fingered hand propping her tousled blonde head away from the back of her seat. The other hand gestured with a cigarette.
"Now that," she continued, "was the mother of all exemplary kills. No one ever thought Eddie Quain was coming back to work, except maybe as lubricant."
Somebody laughed, nervous laughter. Someone else took it up, more certainly, and the sound built around the table. Bryant joined in. The moment passed. Chris gave Machen one more hard look and then started laughing himself. The evening spread its wings under him.
Chapter 5. An unclear space of time later, he was relieving himself in a scarred porcelain urinal that reeked as if it hadn't been cleaned in a week. Yellowed plaster walls crowded around him. Sullen, gouged graffiti ranged from brutal to incomprehensible and back. "Plaster gangwits in your soup. Your rags suit them. Fuck off, Marky cunt. Money makes the world go brown. Emma sucked my prick here. You sucked it yourself. Zective shit. Bring the ombudsman. Fuck the UN. Piss on you too. Meet the rich." It wasn't always clear where one message ended and the other began. Either that, or he was very drunk. He was very drunk. Bryant's idea, as numbers in the hotel bar began thinning, carry the party over into the cordoned zones.
"They may be shit poor over there," a voice blurred as he leaned across the table, "but they know how to have a good time. There's a couple of places I know you can buy all sorts of interesting substances over the counter, and they've got floor shows you wouldn't believe."
Liz Linshaw wrinkled her sculpted features.
"Sounds strictly for the boys," she said. "If you gentlemen would excuse me, I'm for a cab."
She kissed Bryant on the lips, causing a small storm of whoops and yells, and left with a sideways grin at Chris. A couple of other women excused themselves from the group in her wake, and Mike's expedition began to look in danger of fizzling out.
"Oh, come on, you bunch of pussies," he slurred. "What are you afraid of? We've got guns."
He yanked out his Nemex and brandished it.
"We've got money. We've got this city by the balls. What the fuck kind of life is it when we own the fucking streets they walk on and the blocks they live in, and we're still fucking scared to go there? We're supposed to be in charge of this society, not in hiding from it."
It wasn't speech-making of Louise Hewitt caliber, but he managed to rope in half a dozen of the younger men around the table and a couple of the harder-drinking women. 10 minutes later, Chris was in the passenger seat of Bryant's BMW, watching the emptied streets of the financial district roll by. In the back seat sat a nameless young male executive and an older woman called Julie Pinion. Macho sales talk snarled back and forth between them. In the wing mirror, the following lights of two other cars. Sean was descending on the cordon zones in force.
"Okay, you two keep it down," Mike said over his shoulder as they turned a corner.
Up ahead, the lights of a zone checkpoint frosted the night sky.
"They won't let us through here if they think there's going to be trouble."
He brought the BMW to a remarkably smooth halt at the barrier and leaned out as the guard approached. He was, Chris noticed, chewing gum to mask the alcohol on his breath.
"Just going down to the Falkland,"
Bryant called cheerfully, waving his Sean Associates plastic.
"Take in the late show."
The guard was in his 50s, with a spreading paunch beneath his grey uniform, and broken veins across his nose and cheeks. Chris saw the cloud of vapour he made when he sighed.
"Have to scan that, sir."
"Course."
Bryant handed over the card and waited, while the guard ran it through his hip-swipe remote and handed it back. The unit chimed melodically, and the guard nodded. He seemed tired.
"You armed?"
Bryant turned back into the car.
"Show the men your peacemakers, guys."
Chris slid the Nemex out of its shoulder holster and displayed it. Behind him he heard the two back-seat disputants doing the same. The guard shone his flashlight in the windows and nodded slowly.
"Want to be careful, sir," he told Bryant. "There's been layoffs at Patton's and Greengage this week. Lot of angry people out getting drunk tonight."
"Well, we'll stay out of their way," Bryant said easily. "Don't want any trouble, just want to see the show."
"Yeah, okay."
The guard turned back to the checkpoint cabin and gestured to whoever was inside. The barrier began to rise.
"I've got to check your friends as well. You want to park just past the gate till we clear them?"
"Be glad to,"
Mike beamed, and drove the BMW through. The second car passed muster, but with the third there was some trouble. They peered back and saw the guard shaking his head while suited forms craned from the windows front and back, gesturing.
"What the fuck is going on back there?" muttered Julie Pinion. "Couldn't they even act sober for a couple of minutes?"
"Stay here,"
Bryant said, and climbed out into the night air. They watched him walk back to the third car, lean down and say something to those leaning out. The heads disappeared back into the vehicle as if on wires. Bryant put his hand on the guard's shoulder and dug in his pocket. Something passed between them. The guard said something to the driver of the third car. A clearly audible whoop of delight bounced out of the windows. Bryant came back grinning.
"Gratuities," he said as he got into the car again. "Ought to be compulsory, the shit they pay those guys."
"How much did you give him?" asked Pinion.
100.
"100? Jesus!"
"Oh, come on, Julie. I've tipped waiters better than that, and he's going to take a lot more heat than a waiter if this dinner party goes awry."
The little convoy pressed on into the cordon zone. It was an abrupt transition. In the financial district, street lighting was a flood of halogen, chasing out shadows from every corner. Here the street lamps were isolated sentinels, spilling a scant pool of radiance at their feet every 20 meters of darkened street. In some places they were out, lamps either fused or smashed. Elsewhere they had been destroyed more unambiguously, rendered down to jagged concrete stumps still attached to their trunks by a riot of cables and metal bands.
"Look at that," Pinion said disgustedly. "What a bunch of fucking animals. It's no wonder nobody wants to spend money fixing these places up. They'd just tear it all down again."
Even the street beneath their wheels changed. Within 100 meters of the checkpoint, the ride turned bumpy, and Bryant had to slow down and negotiate rain-filled potholes the size of small garden ponds. On either side, the houses huddled. Here and there, for no visible reason, one had been taken down, sprawling smashed brick and spilled interior in the space it had stood. There were no other vehicles on the streets, moving or parked. A few figures moved on the pavement on foot, but they grew immobile as the twilight blue armored sedans with their Shawn Associates logos rolled by. Most turned up their collars, or simply sank back into the shadows.
"Fucking creepy," said the young executive behind Chris. "I mean, I knew it was bad out here, but..." "Bad?" Julie Pinion coughed laughter at him. "You think this is bad? Mike, you remember the suburbs in that shithole we got assigned to for Christmas last year?"
"Muong Kong? Yeah." Bryant looked in the rear view. "Gives you a whole new perspective on what real poverty is, man. Chris, you ever been on overseas duty? With emerging markets, I mean?"
"Couple of times, yeah."
"Pretty awful, huh?"
Chris remembered the call of a muezzin in the warm evening air, smells of cooking, and a small child prodding 3 goats homeward. Later, he'd been walking past a stone and thatch dwelling when a young girl of about 14 came out and offered him fruit from their dinner table because he was a guest in the village. The unlooked-for kindness, with its hints of an antique and alien culture, had pricked tears out on the underside of his eyes. He never told anyone.
"It wasn't somewhere I would have wanted to live," he said.
Pinion smirked.
"No shit,"
she agreed. The Falkland. A squat brick building at the intersection of two streets, still boasting a picturesque scattering of car wrecks. The vehicles looked old enough to have burned leaded fuel when they were alive. Mike Bryant's little convoy swept to a disdainful halt and disgorged suits.
"No cars," the young executive said wonderingly. "I only just noticed." "Of course no cars," said Pinion, rolling her eyes in Chris's direction. "Who, outside of criminals, do you suppose can afford a tank of fuel around here, or a license come to that?"
"Price of the green agenda," said Mike as he alarmed the car. "Are you guys coming, or what?"
The door of the Falkland was beaten steel. Two black men in coveralls stood outside, one dangling a sawn-off shotgun negligently from his left hand, the other, older, watching the street, arms folded impassively across his chest. When he spotted Mike Bryant, he unwrapped and his face split into a huge grin. Mike lifted a hand in greeting as he crossed the street.
"Hey, Troy, what are you doing on the fucking door, man?"
"Protecting my investment,"
the rich treacle of a Jamaican accent.
"Being seen. It's more than I can say for you, Mike. I've not seen you in a fucking long time. What's the matter? Suki not let you out to play any more?"
"That's right," Mike winked, "chopped it off and locked it in the bedroom dresser. That way she can take it out and play with it while I'm at work, which, by the way, is all the fucking time."
"That is the motherfucking truth."
He looked at the entourage Bryant had brought to the bar. "These are friends of yours?"
"Yep. Julie, Chris, meet Troy Morris. He owns this shithole, among others. Troy, Julie Pinion, Chris Faulkner. The rest I don't remember."
Bryant waved back at the entourage he was trailing.
"Just sycophants. You know how it is when you're an important man."
The Jamaican reeled off a deep chuckle.
"Faulkner," he rumbled. "No relation of William, right?"
Chris blinked, confused. Before he could ask, Mike Bryant broke in again.
"They're all carrying, Troy. Left mine in the car, but these guys are new and they don't know the rules. Bear with us. You got a bag for the hardware?"
With a dozen-odd pistols dumped into a greasy hold-all clearly reserved for this specific purpose, they pushed inside. Quiet slammed down through the smoke-hung bar. Even the girl on the stage stopped mid-writhe, one doped boa constrictor gripped in each fist. Music thumped on behind her, suddenly unchallenged by voices. Mike nodded to himself, took a chair to the center of the bar, and climbed onto it.
"As you may have noticed," he said, pitching his voice above the music, "we are Zectives. I know that may pass for a crime around here, but we don't want any trouble. All we want is to buy a drink for everyone in the house and have a few ourselves. Anyone who has a problem with that can come and have a word with me or my friend Troy Morris, and we'll sort your problem out. Otherwise, it's open bar for the next 10 minutes, and the drinks are on me."
He turned to the girl on the stage.
"Please, the show must go on. It looks like we got here just in time."